Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Farmers rival meteorologists when it comes to their intense focus on the weather. After all, a farmer's livelihood depends on favorable winds, timely precipitation, and sunlight. But the climate is changing, and whether or not you believe that change is even partly caused by human activity, warmer winters, wetter springs, and in 2019, the hottest summer on record, are taking a toll on the crops. Some farmers already have started to adapt. Others are coming around. We're talking about the U.S. agriculture and climate change today and how to sustainably grow the food that feeds the U.S. and much of the rest of the world. Georgina Gustin covers agriculture for the Pulitzer Prize-winning Inside Climate News, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on the environment. Welcome to the show, Georgina.
Hi, Ann.
Nationally, farmers have been slow to acknowledge climate change. What are the politics of that, given how important weather is to their livelihood?
Yeah, it's kind of an ironic situation. Historically, farmers have voted quite conservatively, and the conservative position on climate change has been that first it isn't a problem or doesn't exist, and now a little bit more coming around to this notion that, okay, the climate is changing, but human activity isn't causing it. And that idea has really taken root in a lot of rural areas, which are largely conservative. And so you have a situation where farmers who are so dependent on the weather are battling these weather extremes that are driven by climate change, but in some cases just, or in a lot of cases, just aren't really willing to connect the dots between climate change and what's happening on their farms. That's changing, though. Mm-hmm. I think more farmers are recognizing that this is a problem and that they can do something about it.
Well, not only that, but there's evidence that they are part of the problem, which has been hard to swallow.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of emissions that come from farms. Overall, you know, about 10% of U.S. emissions are linked to agriculture. Globally, that number is a lot higher, more on the order of 30% if you include the entire food supply chain. And you know, there are tractors that use fossil fuels, fertilizers that have very high nitrous oxide emissions, methane from factory, from larger industrial farms. So they are indeed part of the problem, but they're in this unique position of being able to be part of the solution, too.
Right, by capturing the things in the soil that matter so much.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing really is soil health. And in this country, we have not taken very good care of the soil largely, and there's been a lot of erosion. And but soil, when it's healthy, has this ability to sequester carbon, and all that farmland that's out there, if the soils are in good shape, can trap a lot of carbon, and that would go a long way towards you know, cutting greenhouse gas emissions, which we know we need to do to forestall the worst effects of the climate crisis. And it's not the only thing we need to do, but it is one easy thing we can do. It's sort of low-hanging fruit, and we need to be kind of pulling out all the stops in our global effort to control emissions. And soil is a very easy way helping hit those global emissions targets.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about climate change today and agriculture, a big relationship there on several levels. My guest right now, Georgina Gustin, she's a reporter for Inside Climate News. If you have a question or comment about the issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's been a split in the agricultural community for a long time. I mean, we've been talking about capturing carbon. We've been talking about no-till farming, you know, cover crops, the whole thing for, gosh, I mean, 100 years ago when I graduated from college. I mean, it just seems like it's been going on forever. Why the politics of this? Farmers are mostly scientists, aren't they?
Yeah, it's It's quite complicated, actually, but largely the reason these methods that you referred to, cover crops and no-till, these are actually really old methods of farming. But with the onset of synthetic fertilizers 50 years ago or so, and the consolidation in the industry and the way the policies are structured, farmers aren't really incentivized to deploy these practices because they cost them money. And when you're operating on really thin margins, as farmers often are, you don't have the time and the resources to do these things. I mean, increasingly more farmers are doing them, which is good, but there needs to be better policy incentives in place. And a lot of people talk about developing a carbon market in which agriculture can play a role. But some people think that that's not such a great idea because it doesn't really get at the root of the problem. And other people say, well, we should just be paying farmers to trap carbon in the soil. All of these solutions haven't really come together. You're right that, you know, these methods have been something that have been, you know, talked about forever and ever, and yet so few farmers are using them. I think it's on the order of like 4% are cover cropping. And no-till, the number is a lot higher. But it's and those numbers are going up, and that 4% might be a little higher now, actually. But farmers just aren't really incentivized to do these things, and so that needs to change somehow. And a lot of it is, you know, sort of a broader policy problem where farmers in this country are incentivized to produce more and more and more and more. And the whole system is based on overproduction. And when you have a system like that, you're just going to throw everything you can at the soil to earn, you know, to get a crop. And most of the time, that's not a very good thing for the soil, which we know is an active living thing that we haven't treated very well. And we need to treat a lot better in order to play this really important role in the climate crisis.
As far as last year goes, it was memorable for us here in the Midwest because of the flooding and the rains that went on forever and ever, and then went right straight from flooding to, it felt like, a drought.
Right. It was really hot. Yeah.
I mean, it was just totally messed up. I can't remember, but it was, I think, only 25% of the farmers in Ohio, which, by the way, agriculture is the state's biggest industry, were even able to get crops in the ground. What does a year like that do to the business of agriculture? Does it see more consolidations? Is there anything concrete that's happened from that?
That's a good question. Well, the farm economy is not in great shape generally. Take the weather out of it. It's already in bad shape because of Trump's trade policies and low commodity prices. And then you throw in this historic flooding last year, that crazy, amount of, really hot days. And you have a lot of farmers struggling, and they got a lot of insurance payouts last year.
Right.
They were bailed out twice by Trump to the tune of $28 billion over 2018 and 2019.
For the trade policies.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. And so, there's a lot of evidence actually that some farmers, particularly large scale farmers, are actually doing pretty well, and farm income is not in the terrible shape you might expect it to be, given everything that's going on. But I do think, from a climate perspective, I was just at the American Farm Bureau convention. This is it's the largest farm lobby in the country, very powerful politically. And largely conservative, still doesn't connect the dots between human activity and climate change. And I spoke to people there, a lot of farmers, who say that they now feel like the climate is changing, But they're still reluctant to, one told me that they still want the science to tell them that climate change is connected to human activity. And we know overwhelmingly that it is. And yet in this, you know, in this, among this cohort of people, there's just still this reluctance. But I do think it's changing a little bit. And I talked to lots of farmers who are changing their practices and realizing that soil, if they take better care of it, there's this double benefit. It helps from a climate perspective, but it also helps them produce a better yield. So I think the mindset is changing a little bit.
What about the mindset among the large-scale farming operations?
Well, so we know that there's a lot of consolidation in the American agriculture industry, and a lot of, for example, in Iowa, obviously a huge farming state, I think it's something to the tune of 60% of the land is farmed by people who lease the land. And so, and these are, you know, large corporate farms that are leasing this land, and they are really not incentivized to take good care of that land. All they really care about is getting a crop. It's not their land. And so you have American farmers reluctant to sell their land because it's quite valuable. Mm-hmm. But you have them leasing them out, leasing all this land out. And so you have, you know, basically tenants that aren't in many cases doing the right thing in terms of stewardship. And when you have these huge industrial operations, they're monocultures, they're just producing one or two things year after year. And that isn't the best thing for the soil. When you a smaller sort of traditional diversified farm of the kind that we really don't have anymore.
The kind we visualize when we think of a farm.
Right. But really doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's economically almost impossible, mm-hmm, to run an operation like that. It's certainly making your living off, you know, just on that farm, you would have an outside job, to make ends meet. But that kind of farm really is this wonderful closed system where you have, livestock on the land in the winter, it's basically like encouraging soil turnover. Their manure fertilizes the land, and you have kind of this system that exists in this sort of holistic way. That doesn't really happen anymore. You have these large farms that are really polluting. And of course, in Ohio, there's a huge water quality issue associated,
right,
with this because of all the giant concentrated animal feeding operations that are popping up, to the extent of which we barely have a handle on, and it's across the Midwest, but the water quality issues are huge. And so if you were to manage that a little bit better, or a lot better, you wouldn't have the water quality issues that you have in Lake Erie. And but there would also be an associated climate benefit, because you would lower emissions at the same time.
But it sounds like that the nation is headed in the opposite direction with the recent decisions by the Trump administration to pull back on water safety regulations and that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, agriculture is very lightly regulated to begin with.
They don't sound like they are, though. They sound
I'm
like
sorry?
The, when you hear the president talk like he did at the Farm Bureau meeting recently, it sounds like they're just completely overwhelmed by regulation.
Yeah, that's just honestly, that's just not the case. I mean, their greenhouse gases are not not measured. Their fertilizer use isn't regulated. CAFOs have to have larger CAFOs have to have permits under the Clean Water Act, but that is basically it. And so that's a refrain that you hear from Trump and from, you know, farm industry leadership and the Farm Bureau. But the agriculture has basically, writ large, has basically been able to push away any kind of environmental regulation. That's been the case for years and years and years. And the waters of the U.S. rule, which is the one you referred to, that, mm-hmm. that the Trump administration rolled back, got farmers whipped into this frenzy because the Farm Bureau and others said that regulators are going to, from the EPA, are going to come and inspect every, you know, puddle on your land. And that really just wasn't the case. And so even that sort of modest attempt to regulate water associated with farms was rolled back by this administration. And when farmers tell me we're overregulated, I always say, okay, well, tell me where are the regulations? Mm-hmm. Because they're just not there from an environmental standpoint.
Georgina Augustin, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Georgina Augustin is a reporter for Inside Climate News. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to hear from an organic grain farmer in Wayne County in Ohio, and also an atmospheric scientist from the Bird, Polar, and Climate Research Center here at Ohio State. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Farmers are like meteorologists in that they are intensely focused on the weather, which can make or break a growing season. As the climate changes, which it is, the weather has become more unpredictable than ever. Warmer winters, wetter springs, and in 2019, the hottest summer on record are taking a toll on the crops. Some farmers already have made changes to how they manage their land. Others are coming around. We'll talk about the challenges today. Aaron Wilson is an atmospheric scientist at the Ohio State Bird, Polar, and Climate Research Center. He also is a climate specialist with the OSU Extension, and that means he reaches out on behalf of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences to farmers. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be here.
Scott Myers is an organic grain farmer and owner of Woodland Acres Farm in Dalton. That's in Wayne County, Ohio. He's changing his methods to adapt to the climate. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. Glad to be here.
And both Scott and Aaron were speakers at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association conference this past weekend in Dayton. The conference focused on climate change. You know, we were talking a little earlier, Scott Myers, about the U.S. Farm Bureau having their meeting recently as well. And their focus was anything but climate change, except in a kind of a derogatory way. There's a big rift in the agricultural community right now.
Yes, there is. That seems to be a real issue. There's a lot of people, even my neighbors, that basically deny that climate change is even happening.
Regardless of who's causing it.
Right. Correct.
So iterations. There's the complete deniers. There's the deniers or the acceptors, except that humans aren't involved or we don't know yet. And then there's, I guess, you who you're adapting. What does adaptation mean in, 2020?
We're trying to adapt to the heavier rainfall events. We have a lot more frequent heavier rainfalls. It used to be we were used to a quarter, half an inch of rain, and now we get 3-4 inches at a time.
Yeah.
So we're trying to adapt to that heavy rain, the runoff from that. And how do we deal with that? And then how do we get back into our fields timely to work with our crop, whether that be weeding, fertilizing, or taking care of our crop? And then just how do we make sure that our crop survives and that our soil microbes and our soil life survives?
It seems like there is a very short-term approach to farming now, and there's also a long-term approach. But the biggest agricultural entities are taking that short-term approach.
Yes. Yeah.
How much crop can I get out this year?
Yeah. That seems to be farming has become a more society in general. We want it right now. We're not worried about long term and what is the environment going to look like for our children. I have four boys at home, and hopefully they'll take over the farm someday. And I want to leave the farm in better shape than what it is now for them. And I'm trying to think about what will be there for them.
This is such a bread and butter issue, not to, belabor, cliches too much, Aaron Wilson. And it's one thing to be a research scientist at the Bird Polar and Climate Research Center. It's another to be out there on the farms with people trying to help them make do with this.
Absolutely. This opportunity, and that's what it is that I've had over the last 3 years with Extension, to really personalize what climate change is and how it's impacting every single person of the state, has been very rewarding. And I've, through feedback, I do feel like the message is getting out there. I think farmers across the state, I've seen a slow progression over the last 3 years toward more acceptance that things are changing, they're different, and that the way we did things 50, 60, 70 years ago is not working under this current climate. And so just making it as personal as possible, I think, is really the touch and that's needed, really, to widen and broaden that message.
It seems like when we say current climate, to me what makes this change in this period we're in right now is that it's constant change. We just don't know.
Yeah, so and to kind of illustrate that, if we look at our top 10 wettest years, for instance, six of the top 10 wettest years in Ohio back to 1895 have all occurred since 2003. So this idea that, over this 124, 125 year time span, some of our wettest years and the majority of our wettest years have really occurred in the last decade or two. And so the last, few years, these types of rainfall in 2018 and 2019, it's really more of a normal that we've seen over the last 20, 25 years.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about agriculture and climate change today. That's Aaron Wilson. He's a research scientist at the Ohio State University Bird Polar and Climate Research Center, and he also is a climate specialist with the OSU Extension. Also with us, Scott Myers. He's an organic grain farmer and owner of Woodland Acres Farm in Dalton in Wayne County. He's changing his methods to adapt to climate change. Both of them were speakers at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association conference this past weekend in Dayton. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Sarah in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I am one of those little itty-bitty farmers, and I do all of those sustainable practices. And with the increased rain that we've had, I've had to redo all of my waterways to protect against erosion. And your first speaker was talking about what the big producers mm-hmm. do, and you find the products of the big producers at your grocery stores, at your bulk food stores. You find us sustainable farmers at your farmer's market, and chances are we know somebody who knows somebody who is producing the product that the customer wants. I don't use any chemicals at all on my acreage. After all, I have a well water, and any chemicals I would put on my land would filter down into my aquifer and would contaminate my water. So I'm highly motivated to not use chemicals and to be very sustainable. I find that I have to use cover crops so that I don't end up with weeds that would require some heroic effort if you're hand weeding.
Mm-hmm.
And we're here. Find us at farmers market.
Okay, I go to the farmers market every week. So, and a lot of people do. Obviously, we're in the dead of winter, and there aren't that many out there. There is the Worthington Farmers Market at the Worthington Mall, though, every single Saturday. When you're hearing Sarah, I hear Sarah, and what I hear in her voice is frustration that they're not getting more attention, Aaron Wilson. Mm-hmm. Are most of the people that you're working with, are the Sarahs out there, or are they bigger farmers, or is it a mix?
It's a good mix, okay, actually. Good. So each educator within the county does a really great job of programming and diverse programming that brings, you know, farms of all sizes really to the conversation. And, you know, you can hear all of the impacts through Sarah's statement there in terms of pests and weeds and water and erosion and all of these things. This is why we call climate change a threat multiplier. We can do what we love to do and what we need to do. It just makes it a lot harder to do it. And that's really what I think her example illustrates.
Does it feel like a day late and a dollar short sometimes, Scott Myers, that it's almost too late? We had a caller earlier. We weren't able to get him on, but they wondered, are we headed to another Dust Bowl someday?
Yeah, I don't want to say it's too late. I don't think it's ever too late to make a change. We can always start somewhere, but we are seeing the, you know, firsthand the issues with climate change of warmer winters, warmer nighttime temperatures and stuff, which we all can see right now. But it works with all sizes of farmers. It doesn't matter, and that's one neat thing about OFA and at the conference was there were farmers there.
There are big farmers there too?
Big farmers, small farmers, people with just a garden, urban farmers. Ohio State has a really good program working with urban farming right now. And so that they have those represented clear up to larger farmers. We're one of the larger organic farms in the state. It's not something I'm really proud of. It's not size that counts. It's the you know, what you're doing and how we handle things. And we have, you know, we try to do the best we can with what we have. And do the best job we can for the environment.
You know, when I talk to the Ohio Farm Bureau, they tell me that, you know, farmers and their members are some of the most ecologically conscientious people they know, that they care about, like you do, Scott Myers, the water and the soil and who's going to take up the farm. One of the things that a lot of people disconnect with the soil is they figure if it's brown and it's dirt, it's got to be good. And soil can be very misleading and when it comes to what it looks like, the nutrients and that sort of thing. And there's the issue of carbon capture in soil that we can help to fix some of the problems by just changing how we treat the soil.
Yeah, I think from an adaptation standpoint, the person you had on earlier was speaking a little bit to this, the fact that soil health and water quality health and water health are very much tied into this climate adaptation. And as we improve our soils for the benefit of improving crops and things like that, we're also building in climate adaptation measures, increasing the capacity of water capacity, for instance, on the fields, additional roots,
having
erosion
those cover crops
control,
in there, that
cover
kind
crops.
Of a thing.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, as a Farm Bureau member, which I am, even though, you know, I don't always agree with what they go with, but I do think they're making a good stride in that, pushing cover crops to help make the soil better soil tilth, better water infiltration. We have to start somewhere. Personally, I don't think they're maybe going far enough.
There's the issue of how much crop comes up, and farmers are rewarded for overplanting versus maybe underplanting and creating different methods of filtering the water, using the land for that instead of for growing crops and that kind of a thing. That seems to be a big debate.
Yeah, that is. And we actually supply cover crop seed to some programs that home or soil and water programs that cover that. And, you know, like I said, it's a start. It's more about crop rotation, and that's something, as an organic farmer, we have a very diverse crop mix. We're not just raising corn and soybeans. We have something growing on almost all of our acres year-round. We raise hay. That's one of the best cover crops out there. It's a long-term perennial. It holds the soil. It digs down deep, brings up the nutrients from down deep, and then we're also raising small grains. It's the way our state has moved away from their big rotations, the other crops out there like small grains and stuff, to just corn and soybeans because that's what's being pushed and what the market wants. But if we would move back to what we did 50 years ago as far as the crops we raise, then I think we could fix a lot of our problems, possibly.
And if I could add, too, you know, I've had several opportunities over the last couple of years to actually engage with the Farm Bureau, and they've reached out to come in and talk to the policy folks and to talk about these are the challenges that we're seeing. And so I think they're exploring ways of integrating this climate change information into their program to get it out to their members. So I do think they're making a push to include more of this information and more of these tactics.
Yeah, that's what I've noticed, at a very different tone from them than from the Nationals.
Yeah, that's definitely. I think our Ohio organization is doing a wonderful job compared to the American Farm Bureau on a lot of things. And so we do. That's a good place for farmers to support the Farm Bureau and what they're doing here locally.
Deb in Mount Vernon, you're on the air. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I just wanted to say hi to Scott, see how Nicole and the boys are doing. I'm his aunt by marriage.
Okay.
And I want to do the tiniest tease because 15 years ago when I moved back to Ohio, he harassed me for organic gardening.
Yeah, you're right,
well,
Deb.
Well, what brought
from, yeah.
So Deb's telling us that you've had a change of heart, that you haven't always been here in this place.
Correct.
What changed?
Well, a lot of things, actually. I've been farming for about 20 years, and we started with hay. Our family's been farming since the 1930s, but we started with hay, and we raise a lot of hay for dairy farms. And
there's a shortage of hay.
There's a very serious shortage of hay. So a lot of my dairy farms started to switch, and in a very short time span, they switched to organic. This was probably 7-8 years ago, and so we kind of started to follow the market. That's how what started it, and then we realized we were almost doing everything that we could be. That we could do organically, we could do what we're doing and continue those crop rotations. And then we started to do research and find out that our yields aren't lower. There's a lot of misconceptions about organic, and some of them are the yields are lower, you're going to have more weed pressure. And if organic's done correctly, you can raise just as good of crop, if not better. Sometimes it's nutritionally better.
And chemical-free.
Right, it's chemical-free, and we can raise just as good a yield. And on the profit side, it can be much more profitable for the farmers involved. It's a way for a farmer to make a good living and not be tied to government subsidies and government programs, and be taking care of the land.
Would you welcome government subsidies and government programs, though, if it benefited organic farming?
To be honest, I don't. I am not in favor of it. We still participate in government programs because we need to have a level playing field, basically, so we all do. But if they moved away from government programs, that wouldn't hurt. I wouldn't be mad about that. But I would say I think they should at least focus the government programs more on conservation-based things, not just hand out money like they did in the MFP payments here recently, the last couple of years, where they just hand it out for nothing. They should at least be tied to practices that the farmers do to conserve the soil, conserve soil and water, and help their, you know, help with climate change.
Aaron Wilson, what is your sense about the level of understanding out there about what climate change actually is? And, you know, we used to call it global warming, and that was a misnomer from the get-go. It doesn't mean necessarily we're going to be warmer.
Right.
But it does take on that effect sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, the semantics of the whole conversation have all, you know, they've changed over time. And then it was climate change, and even that fell out. And then we started focusing on extreme events. And I think it's very important to, when I'm teaching, is to talk about the differences in weather and climate. The fact that weather patterns over a longer period of time really establish what our climate, what our temperature and moisture and winds should, we're expecting over a longer period of time. And so understanding those differences helps us understand then that in an above average winter, we can get polar vortex events or very cold air that comes down. And by the way, that can actually do more damage than cooler temperatures overall in a mean sense, because then you don't have the hardiness in things like specialty crops, or you're driving alfalfa up out of the ground because it's constant freeze-thaw cycles. And so I think people are starting to understand that it is a complex, wicked problem, and that is true for farming as well, with a lot of interactions and different outcomes depending on what the conditions are like.
Let's see. I want to get to Dane in Mount Sterling real quick before we take a break. Hi, Dane. It's you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment a little bit on the earlier guest that you had on relating to some industrial farming practices.
Large farming, and, yeah, right?
Yeah. So a little bit of the picture that she painted is really not accurate. I personally am involved in agriculture in all aspects of my life. I raise livestock. I work on a large grain farm. You know, and we have to cover thousands of acres. It's still owned and operated by one family. There are no large corporate-owned farms in this area. I mean, we're half an hour south of Columbus, and I know most of the landowners around. There are, yes, there is a lot of land that is leased, but those people still understand that the soil health is a major factor for the longevity of their operation. And the idea that fertilizer and pesticides and any inputs in general are being thrown at the goal of purely raising a higher yield on mm-hmm. whatever crop is really not accurate, because the farmer is worried about efficiency on all assets, whatever the operation is.
Do you have a sense, Dane, though I guess the point was made by Georgina Augustin, that the larger U.S. policy toward farming seems to be geared toward yields versus soil health long term?
Like what policy?
Policies like subsidies, that kind of a thing. So they're paying farmers to grow more. Are they also paying the farmers who are making sacrifices to preserve their soil quality?
But the subsidies that were given out recently really were not incentivized for people to grow more. I mean, there is no subsidy that says if you grow X amount, you get paid more. If you grow more, you get to sell more. Now, if you had to put more money into it to get that extra yield than what you got in return, it still didn't benefit you.
It's a zero. Okay. And Scott Myers, what do you think about that? Thank you, Dane.
And government subsidies by nature are, I mean, the government, it's cheap food is what they're trying to do. They try to maintain a cheap food and plenty of food. You know, they mm-hmm. don't want to have, you know, that's always been what the idea was behind government subsidies. So the idea there is more, you know, produce more. You know, farmers are always bragging about, oh, I raised this many bushels of the acre of corn. They're always talking about yield contests and see how much they can raise. If everybody raised the amount that they raised in some of the yield contests, $4 conventional corn would be a really high number because they'd probably double the production. So I agree with what Dane says, though. Coming from the conventional farming side, you know, for many years, you know, and a larger scale, you know, we try to do the best. It's still about profitability and economics, and you look at your bottom line. Mm-hmm. The problem is when corn and bean prices, conventional corn and bean prices, were very high a few years ago, some of that got thrown out the door, and people were all about, hey, we need to produce more because now corn's $7, and, you know, that product that costs $20 an acre to apply that we wouldn't have applied when it was $4. Now, we're just going to throw that on. And a lot of people are still doing that and still trying, you know, and a lot of people would advertise that's the new normal. And so we all geared up to produce many, many more bushels of corn. And then there's also the thinking of we got to double our output by 2050 to feed the world.
Right.
And that's a whole nother issue when it
comes
to that.
Brings up a whole nother issue. Dane, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about agriculture and climate change. Agriculture's a big business in Ohio. But Ohio was one of those states that also was experiencing these warmer winters, wetter springs, and in 2019, the hottest summer on record. All of that's taking a toll on the crops. In response, some farmers are adopting new ways to sustainably grow the food that feeds the U.S. and much of the rest of the world. Still with us is Scott Myers. He's an organic grain farmer and owner of Woodland Acres Farm in Dalton in Wayne County, Ohio. And also Aaron Wilson. He's an atmospheric scientist with the Bird Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State. He also is the climate specialist with the OSU Extension, the outreach arm of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences. Aaron Wilson, I'm just kind of wondering what the message is. What kind of questions do farmers ask you about what you know about climate change and why it's happening? What are they curious about?
Usually the number one question and the first question is, what's causing it? Which is always a great segue. I usually hold it for the question period because I think very succinctly we can show, that the composition of the atmosphere has changed, that this is largely due to burning of fossil fuels, and combustion and increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And when we have more carbon dioxide and it's warmer, we have more water vapor in the atmosphere. Energy from Earth's surface gets absorbed by those particles, and by the definition, our temperatures go up. But then it's also coming down to making the connections to all the feedbacks. Why losing ice in the Arctic is important, or why losing ice at our tropical glaciers? Why that's important, or it's a sign of our atmosphere warming.
Like 70 degrees in Antarctica over the weekend, or
yeah,
like
certainly.
That.
I mean, again, that's just one point on a long time series showing warmth over warming conditions over a long period of time, and that's why it always goes back to weather and climate, because we live on these weather scales, and trying to understand a 1 degree change over 100 years and why that matters can often be difficult. But the more we talk about it, the more personal we make it, and the more impacts we feel, I think it really starts to set in, that things are different, things have changed even within our lifetime.
Did you, when you went into becoming an atmospheric scientist, did you think about yourself talking to farmers someday?
Well, I mean, a long time ago, I was taking tests in school saying, hey, be an agricultural scientist, right? But I was always hooked on weather. Uh-huh. This provides a great opportunity because farmers are weather geeks. They absolutely love it, and I love the community. They'll come to me, they'll tell me temperatures to a tenth of a degree, precipitation to a hundredth of an inch. They are very in tune with those weather conditions and what's happening. And so that's allowed for a lot of fruitful conversations on this topic.
You spoke over the weekend at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association Conference about agricultural resilience.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so, and there was also another great keynote speaker, Laura Lignick, who actually went into even more about resilience. But, when I think about the term resilience, we often throw these terms sustainability and resilience around. Sustainability to me kind of gives the feeling that we're trying to maintain the conditions, which I think is very important. We're trying to maintain profitability in these changing conditions. But resilience means that we have to respond to the things that we're seeing. We have to, and as Laura puts it, and I think it was very well done by Dr. Lignick, is that we're not just bouncing back, but how do we bounce forward, right? How do we take these changes that we're seeing and learn from them to then be able to withstand 2-3-4 inch rainfall?
Instead of
events,
seeing them as obstacles, see them as
potential opportunities.
Potential opportunities.
How can
okay.
we improve what we're doing in light of these threat multipliers that we see from climate change?
You're nodding, Scott Myers, organic farmer that you are. What can you give me a down-to-earth, no pun intended, example of what we mean by that?
As far as what we're doing?
How are you finding opportunity in these drastic changes?
Yeah, we're changing some of the things we do. One thing, we're actually planting a little shorter season corn because we know we may not be able to plant quite as early in the spring.
And it won't last. You might go into drought.
Right.
In the middle of the cycle.
Maybe have a drought or we may want to get the corn off sooner in the fall so we can plant another crop.
Okay.
That way we have something green growing all year long, holding the soil. We're no-tilling and planting green. So we plant, and conventional farmers do these things as well, planting green. We're going to plant soybeans into a 6-foot tall rye cover crop. crop. It looks really weird when you're doing it because you can't even see the tractor in the field.
Uh-huh.
But it lays the rye down as you plant, and it creates a cover, which not only gets rid of the weeds and keeps the weeds suppressed, but it also helps maintain the soil profile in the soil and improves the soil. And so if you have that drought period, it hopefully will carry over, the moisture will carry over through that.
So what do you mean by planting it on top of the rye?
Well, about middle of May, the rye will have gotten about 6 feet tall.
Okay.
It's a cereal rye variety. And then we use a roller that it has sharp points on it that will actually go across the field on the front of the planter. And as we're planting, it rolls the rye down in front, crimps it so it will not come back up again, and then it will be dead. And then it plants the soybeans, or people plant corn as well in similar crops with the regular row units.
You just punch them in?
It just goes right in through there, no till, no soil disturbance. And it can work really good. Like I said, conventional farmers, it works really good because they do have some chemical options if they have a weed escape. For us, we have some other options, weeding options that we can come back with, some neat tools that are out there now that actually zap the weeds with electricity and things like that.
We had a caller, they couldn't make it in because of a bad connection, but it's Hayden from Pleasantville, and he asked how GMOs help with overrain issues. Genetically modified, organisms.
Yeah, GMO. Yeah. And I'll say I would disagree with that. I don't think GMOs. There are no current GMOs out there that drought tolerance. That has been something that's been talked about.
Uh-huh.
And there are seeds that are that say are better drought tolerant seeds, but there isn't a drought tolerant gene currently commercially available.
But you're talking. But when you were talking about a corn with a shorter...
Okay, that's just a hybrid corn that we can use. That's not a GMO per se thing. That's just the day length maturity of the corn, and all crops have different maturities for different varieties, basically.
And so when we're talking about an overcrop, is literally an overcrop. It's not like something you harvest for rye bread.
Correct.
This is the crop that's planted over the seeds that will come up later, and that's what keeps the weeds out.
Correct. That's, yeah,
we're just planting moisture in the field.
Right,
and
we're just planting a cover crop. Have no intention of harvesting.
And it doesn't compete with that seed.
No, it doesn't. And the idea
is
that we've killed it at that point. Now there are other times where we actually when we seed our hay seedings in the spring, we'll seed oats with it, and then the oats grows faster than the alfalfa, so we harvest the oats, and then we're able to start making the alfalfa after that. So there's also the idea of growing things together.
Huh, it sounds kind of fun, like a puzzle.
It is. It is. Every day is a new adventure on the farm. That's why we love farming, because, you never know what you're going to get every day, and it's the challenge.
I hate to throw this off to the last couple of minutes, but I'm wondering, Aaron Wilson, where the issue of livestock comes into this equation now, something we haven't talked about, but is a big issue because a lot of the grains that are grown in this country now are fed to livestock.
Yeah, I think that certainly gets a lot of attention, and whether we're talking about cow flatulence and burps and things like that. I think one of the important things, if you look at the emissions for our country, for instance, in animal agriculture is really about 3% of our emissions compared to 80% when it comes from fossil fuels. So that you always have to think about a factor analysis there. Animal agriculture gets a lot of blame, perhaps, or a lot of attention, but they're also focusing on a lot of things that will help, mitigate that, right? Can we improve our feed quality, which will help with that as well? Well, by the way, more rainfall in the spring and you can't get your feed out in time, and some of the conditions that we're seeing this year, that's where that threat multiplier lies.
Okay.
We try to...
In feed quality, meaning to lower gas
exactly.
In the animals.
It's digested better.
Right.
And so that's one way that I think there's a lot of attention in this country on improving feed quality, improving efficiency. We're more efficient about the inputs of growing livestock. We're getting, animals, bigger animals, basically more for our inputs. And these are the types of solutions where I really see farming from livestock, but there are other examples from specialty crops and organics and everything of leading, right, these mitigation possibilities as we move into the future.
Well, We're out of time, but it's not the last time we'll talk about this. Of course, Scott Myers, organic grain farmer at Woodland Acres in Dalton, Ohio. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
And Aaron Wilson, research scientist at the Ohio State University Bird, Polar, and Climate Research Center. Thanks for your time as well. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, man. Thanks.
Thanks to everybody else for listening today. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.